when shadows made their mysterious ways around corners and across alleys, and everyone loved sunsets. The light lost its sanity as it fell over the hills and into the Pacific. It went red and deeper red, orange and even green. The skies seemed to melt like lava eating black rock into great bite marks of burning. Sometimes all the town stopped and stared west. Shopkeepers came from their rooms to stand in the street. Families brought out their invalids on pallets and in wheelbarrows to wave their bent wrists at the madness consuming their sky. Swirls of gulls and pelicans like God's own confetti snowed across those sky riots. Angel was afraid of falling off the machine. He wrapped his arms around his father's grand torso, laid his cheek to his back, and only then let his eyelids drop. If he held tight to his father, he would not fall. Even though with his eyes closed, he almost believed his father had levitated them above the earth and was trying to make him tumble through clouds to the desert below. He believed father would hold him aloft. He breathed deep, for he could really smell the world if he was focused, utterly focused. He had already formulated many theories, which is why Don Antonio sometimes called him El Filósofo, for his philosophy was already in place. And this was one of his theorems. To know the world in each of its parts, a seeker must shut out the unnecessary senses and focus on the target. Today, the day he was destined to meet Perla Castro Trasviña in the Centro Police Station at 8:30 in the morning in the magical year of 1963, the world was all sense. It began with his father's back, redolent of cigarette smoke and leather, the wool of his tunic, and the bay rum and shaving soap blowing back from his cheeks, the smell of wind and sun in his uniform and Mama's lye soap, and even a hint of her. Behind these smells and all around them, the sea, the relentless sea, salt and seaweed and shrimp and distance, the bitter stench of beached dolphins turning to gray swamps on the rocks, the scent of mysterious Sinaloa somehow coming across the gulf, the choking reek of guano, and the delicious scent of a million miles worth of clean, rushing wind. Siren! Mi hijo, como chingas! And the smells of the smoke everywhere. Smoke. The world was made of smoke. The sky collected all the burned offerings and built palaces of scents above and around them. Cooking smoke was the best. Carne asada, carnitas, roasted corn with lime and cheese, fried fish, tortillas, diced nopales and scrambled eggs on a cloud of melted lard, yeasty bread smoke from the bakeries, sugar smoke. Shrimp tacos crisp in the breeze. Trash fires. Incense from the shops and the old women's houses and the churches. Cigars. And dust. If the rain came, the creeping smell of the desert going wet. And the diesel and exhaust, especially the big belching trucks and ancient buses. From alleys, the stench of sewage and rotten fruit. Flowers, yes, flowers. They were not just colorful, but their scents colored the air. There came scents then of onion and tomatoes, chiles, and the faintly soapy, strange smell of cilantro, mint leaves, charcoal, perfume, and rank old beer in the tepid squalls of air billowing from cantinas. Somewhere in that vast tapestry of interwoven odors, Angel was sure he could smell the dead. Not their bodies, but their souls. His newest theory was that the dead came as ghosts in the sudden finger-thin wafts of perfume or cigarette or hair's sweet soap scents when it was drying in the sun. And then they were just past the center of town with its drooping wires festooned with lights, left over from Christmas. Tubas were playing in the plaza. Angel opened his eyes when trumpets sounded a nationalistic fanfare. And the engine's blat and rip grew massive and reverberant as they went between walls and up the narrower street to the station, bucking as Don Antonio slowed, cobbles and fractured chunks of concrete in the street. And they stopped before the jail and police station complex. Smells of urine escaped from the barred windows in back. Hopeless, flat human voices came from the barred and wired high windows. Don Antonio revved the engine and cut its noise mid-shriek. They sat as though stunned by their own silence. "You will learn," he said to his son, as if he had been thinking this during the whole trip, "that pink nipples are more intoxicating than brown." Angel looked up to him, his father's face just a shadow now against the sun, and he thought, "What?" And Don Antonio's big shiny boot lifted and went over Big Angel's head as he ducked, and his father stood tall, setting his belt, checking his cap. He pinched his balls through the trousers and shifted his lariat to the left. He looked at the boy and pulled off his dark glasses. He winked. Inside the station, the usual tumult. The stinging smell of ammonia and pine cleaner. Brash echoes of pitiless tiles. Young cops deferred to Don Antonio with shy glances and slightly sideward motions. Their shoes squealed on the floor. Old cops slapped Father's back and fake-punched Big Angel. He flinched. It infuriated Don Antonio, flinching. His dark gnome of a son didn't play guitar or baseball, brooded like some poet. Yes, he was hard on the boy. That was love. Look at this world. He remembered flogging his son. It seemed just yesterday. It had been over a year, but his remorse made it seem fresh, even though he refused to admit to himself that he felt anything but righteousness about it. He was a man, pues, making a man. He had forced Angel to stand naked in the back room. "Bend over," he'd said. "No, papa." The belt hung from Don Antonio's fist. "All right, mijo. Defy me. Make it worse." As he lay 25 stripes across his boy's ass and back, he ordered him, "Do not cry, cabrón." One syllable per blow. "Don't cry, cabrón." The whistle and the snap when it hit. The boy's hands trying to block the blows. "Raise your hands again, pendejo. Raise them to me. That tells me you want to fight me, and I will add 25 to this. Yes, it's what you want. Does that make you happy?" And he looked to see, for he knew that when he whipped naked men in the jail, they sometimes became hard, rising like small branches as they screamed. His boy covered himself with his hand. Don Antonio suddenly lost his strength. His will drained out. His arm fell and he stared at the network of red X's all over Angel's body as if they had appeared miraculously, like the face of Jesus in a cloud. He looked at his son now, regretting it a little. He gripped Angel's shoulder and smiled at him. "I touch your shoulder," he said grandly, "for good luck." "Thank you, Father." He rubbed Angel's head. "Mijo," he said. Honestly, Angel didn't know what to think. He was pretty sure his father didn't care for him much. He leaned around Don Antonio and stared at the suspect's bench. Father turned and looked over there too. And there they were, the Castro family, bedraggled in the no man's land between the front lobby and the dreaded cell blocks in back. Nobody had yet handcuffed them to the gouged wood of the bench. A skinny young man dripping blood in slow, fat, greasy drops from a gashed chin. held his hands together between shivering thighs. He had a black eye. Beside him sat a girl, Perla, with skinny, knobby gray knees and cuts on her face, still sparkling with bits of glass. No more than 15. She had huge eyes, filled with fear, and she clutched the hand of a smaller girl. This would turn out to be the young Gloriosa, playing with a naked doll, twisting its arms as if trying to dismember it. "What is this?" Don Antonio called. "Car wreck," the desk man said. "Anybody die?" "No." Don Antonio snapped his fingers. "Reporte!" he shouted. There was no report. "What do you mean there's no report?" "Shrugs. It is early, jefe. This just happened." The kids on the bench stared at the floor. A cop stepped up and spoke. "This pendejo," he said, pointing to the bloodied boy, "ran into a pickup truck full of ranch hands." "Una pica." "Ah, cabrón," said Don Antonio, looking down at them. Perla started to cry. "Sorry," the boy said. "Where are the cowboys?" "They ran away."
"But you didn't run."
"No, señor. They stopped right in front of me. I didn't have the chance to stop."
"You couldn't stop."
"I couldn't stop." Even Angel knew that in the matter of car wrecks on the peninsula, everyone is arrested and investigated. Even the injured, guilty until proven innocent.
"You didn't know enough to run away too," he said.
"Yes, sir, but I could not leave my father's truck." Angel watched the skinny girl in the middle weep. She was inconsolate. He was immediately in love. He rose into gallantry as if he knew it was demanded of him, pulling his handkerchief out of his back pocket and stepping over to her. He extended his hand. She stared at the white square and then looked at his eyes. He nodded. She took it. A young cop mocked them in almost English. "Everybody's going to jail," he laughed, saying, "Yale!" "Ya pues," Don Antonio said, watching his boy seduce the girl. Angel was in a swoon. She was a bit younger than he was. Don Antonio saw that right away. And wanton. She had that look about her. She already knew how it felt to have a man. He might have gone after her himself. He glanced again at his son. Angel was thinking with his little pistola, Don Antonio saw. He took an inventory of the girl. Her eyes were as huge as a deer's. Her wild hair still dropped pebbles of glass. Her nose was big. Angel reached over and took some glass out of her short black hair. She stared up at him. He smiled at her. She smiled back. Don Antonio thought, he can't even see the smoke coming out of her. "Can I pay a fine?" the wounded boy on the bench said. Don Antonio rose in height and inflated his chest.
"What are you suggesting?"
"I shut your hole." "Yes, sir."
"Are you suggesting that we accept bribes here?"
He used the classic term, la mordida.
"No, sir." "Are we dogs that bite?"
"No, sir."
"Is that what you're calling me? Do I look like a dog to you, pendejo?"
"No, never." Angel glanced up at his father. His father stared back. Christ, he was smitten. He was imploring his father with his eyes. Don Antonio chuckled, looked over at the desk man. They both laughed. The girl had taken her big brother's hand. She was willing to protect him. Don Antonio liked that.
"Está enamorado,"
the other cop at the desk noted.
"Tu hijo."
"You," snapped Don Antonio, pointing at the girl.
"¿Cómo te llamas?"
"Perla Castro Trasviña."
"You could go to jail right now."
She covered her face with her hands. The others continued to stare at the floor. Portrait of a family trying to discover the gift of invisibility. His idiot son pushed into this bedraggled family group and put his arm over her bony shoulders as if he could defend her.
"Perla," Don Antonio finally said, "what does your family do?"
"Restaurant, sir."
"What's it called?"
"La Paloma del Sur."
"If we come to see you, I expect good food. You cook it for us."
"Yes."
She was leaning against Angel. Ah, cabrón. Don Antonio put his hands on his hips. This is your lucky day. He said, take your brother to a doctor. They goggled at him. So did the other cops. Go on, he said. Get out. They scrambled away. I like shrimp tacos, he called as the door slammed shut behind them. The police all laughed. Don Antonio put his hands into his pockets and jangled his change and keys. Mijo, he said, I am the law. Never forget. I will remember, Big Angel promised. The last time Big Angel saw his father in La Paz was at his own farewell party. They had conspired behind his back to be done with him. Parents were mysterious creatures full of plots and plans and secrets. Angel tried to be the guide for Pato and Maria Luisa through the strange landscapes of their parents' marriage, but sometimes even his brilliance was bested by their weirdness. All families were strange, Angel already knew. He didn't like to visit other families because he was always ill at ease. The Basque family down at the end of their alley put bizarre sauces on their food, for example, and the Hallelujah Christian converts kept saying Gloria a Dios and Amen all the time. They kept trying to give him Bibles. He palled around with El Fuma for Fu Manchu due to his attempted mustache, but he steered clear of Fuma's family. They said grace before they ate, and he didn't know the words. Don Antonio would just take his place at the head of the table and await Mama America's food with a rolled-up corn tortilla in his left hand and his elbow on the table, tortilla raised beside his ear like some weapon about to fall. After his erotic night on the beach with Perla, however, Angel saw her and her family every day. Don Antonio could have locked him in one of the rebar-fronted cells at the station, and he would have tunneled out. He barely completed his classes every day in high school before he was first out and hustling across five alleys and four main streets and one dusted plazuela to arrive at the front door of La Paloma del Sur. Then he tried to act very casual, as if he had happened to wander by on his way home, hands in pockets, looking up and down the street, then turning, looking up at the restaurant's front window as if startled that he had ended up before it, squinting in, elaborate performances of nonchalance contorting his features, and the whole while the Castro family inside watching him and laughing. Perla didn't go to school. La Paloma was her school. Her father had drowned in a fishing boat accident, and her brother had signed on to the big tuna boats and gone into the Pacific. So it was her and her sisters, Lupita and Gloriosa, watched over and kept busy by their terrifying mother, Chela, she of the relentless fly swatter, who could find a leg even as the girls ran to escape, she whose voice sounded like a frog and whose squat body looked like a clenched fist, she of the prematurely white hair and the most exquisite frijoles fried in lard of all La Paz. Big Angel would mosey in, blushing like a red electric sign, and the females would ignore him in the elaborate fashion of Mexican women who are watching a man quite carefully, except for Perla, who fluttered and flushed and rushed to place Pepsis and limes in front of him and to waste tortilla chips on him. Chela told her and told her and told her, make men pay. They come in here to look at you. Make them pay for it. Once you give a cabrón anything for free, he'll be all over you and never think of buying you a ring. Look at him. He's pole vaulting across the room every time he sees you. Ay, mama. In back, there was a small courtyard and a shaky metal stairway that led up to one of those improvised concrete block apartments found everywhere in Mexico. An outside sink with yellow water, and inside two rooms and a toilet. Angel never got upstairs to see it. Chela would have broken his legs. But Chela knew a good thing when she saw it. The policeman's son. Yes, mucho dinero, she thought. She could get her girl in that crowd and manage things nicely.
It was a terrible fate, to have a house full of daughters, she thought. But she had been raised to be a ranchera, and she could trade stock and move breeding heifers around to everyone's advantage. So she allowed this simpering romance. Still, she wasn't going to smile at the horny little bastard. Perla wasn't even there when the world changed for Angel. It would take years to see her again, and it would be in Tijuana. His Aunt Cuca had married a pirate. Well, that's what Don Antonio called him. He was half Sinaloan from the legendary town of Chametla. Chametla, where Cortez allegedly sat on a rock on a day so hot, the stone was melting and his nalga cheeks had left a permanent impression. And he was half something else, from one of the many Anglo-Celtic incursions into Sinaloa in pursuit of mining jobs. Vicente or Chente? Chente Bent. Chente Bent, skipper of the heinous fishing boat El Guatabampo. It clanged and farted into La Paz's docks in a miasmic galaxy of stench, attended by hysterias of seabirds engaged in air battles over Chente Bent's offal. Don Antonio called Chente Bent's family Los Cochinos, which made the children giggle while Mama America scowled. Chente Bent had whisked off her younger sister, and she was not dirty. Her sister was now Cuca Bent, just like that, the whole name. For Chente Bent announced himself thusly every time he spoke of himself. He made of the name a kind of brand, all run together, Chente Bent. He could have been selling nasal sprays or a new model Chevy, the all-new Chente Bent. Cuca Bent, as much as she suffered under the toxic attentions of the pirate, deserved more respect than to be called dirty by Don Antonio. And their daughter was Tiki Bent. They had a German shepherd called Capitan Bent. Capi Bent. More than a name, the Bent surname was a pronouncement. Los pinches Bent, Don Antonio complained. El Guatabampo sailed across the Sea of Cortez twice a year in search of sweet La Paz abalone and little rock lobsters. It was a regular celebration when the boat arrived at the La Paz docks. Chente Bent brought flounder and shrimp and sea urchins, whose orange meat made Angel vomit, and octopi and long steaks of oily marlin. Don Antonio would send off for a goat to be shot, and he roasted it in a bed of coals under the ground. They ate and drank beer and belched and gossiped for several days. Tia Cuca Bent and the frizzy-haired cousin Tiki Bent sometimes hitched rides on the old boat, and they came into the family's little courtyard smelling of spoiled fish and perfume. It wasn't especially agreeable to Angel, though Tiki Bent showed an alarming interest in him on that last visit. And whenever the adults weren't watching, she snuck him beers and pressed against him. She had a black eye. "Son, you have real impact on your cousin," Don Antonio whispered. "She smells like Chente Bent." "Ah, cabrón," Don Antonio pulled him aside. "Put Vicks in your nose." It worked. They danced. That day, Cuca Bent and Tiki Bent joined Mama America in cornering Angel. They herded him into his parents' bedroom like a recalcitrant yearling bull. He didn't like all the women closing in on him. "Your eyebrows," Tiki Bent cried. "You look like a crow is stuck on your face." The torture began. Tweezers wielded mercilessly, the women clearing the scrub off his brows and pinching him or insulting him when he squirmed or cried out. They harried his poor face until they had sculpted his extravagant hedge into two surprised-looking Rita Hayworth arches. Forever after, he would make this ritual part of his secret life with Perla. No one would ever know. Don Antonio and Mama America sat him down after his Spanish Inquisition eyebrow experience and informed him that he was going to Mazatlan on El Guatabampo. He cried out in outrage, tinged with delight. He didn't want to leave Perla, yet he didn't mind missing school, and he had never taken a long boat ride or seen far Mazatlan, the big city, where all the sophisticates lived. They thought he was stupid, as parents often do. Well, he was stupid, as children often are. He had no idea he was being moved aside to facilitate the dissolution of their marriage. Don Antonio had for years engaged in mysterious visits to the northern border on police work. Mama America knew he was visiting a cousin, a secret lover of his in Tijuana, but he really had his eye on the other side. In those days, Mexican men wanted two things, American cars and American women. He had told her that very week he was leaving her for the other woman, but she knew what the other woman didn't know. Antonio would leave that woman, too. She never let out one word of this betrayal to the kids. She was not about to beg him to stay or to let her horror show. She knew, however, that she could not deal with Angel's stormy emotions once the betrayal hit. The little ones would be hard enough. She and Don Antonio would have to move Angel out of the house before the world collapsed around them. Hence, the idea for him to leave with Chintibent. Sometimes she imagined poisoning Don Antonio, a little rat poison in his coffee. The plan was for Don Antonio to board the long-haul bus as soon as Angel the sailor set out to sea. By the time their son found out, the damage would already be done, and time would have passed. Letters were slow. Don Antonio demanded only one thing of his wife and her sister, that his son never be known as Angel Bent. Mama America thought of Don Antonio's old gray upright piano, which sat in a corner of the house. He had bought it from a rotten cantina on the outskirts of town, where desert rats slumped in the dark drinking pulque and mezcal. The owner had sold it to him for $100. It was covered in cigarette burns and stains, but he loved it. He played it for the family every day. He played a few Agustin Lara tunes now for the party. After he was gone, America decided, she would chop it up for firewood. All through that smoky last supper with the Bents crowding the small table under the plum tree, America never dropped her faint smile. The Harley was parked beside the back wall of the garden, exuding malevolent energies from beneath its shroud. She was smiling because she planned to roll it into the sea as soon as her bastard of a husband was settled in his bus seat. Chintibent was telling appalling jokes that made Mama America send the smaller children to their beds. Angel was hypnotized by these nights when his father drank liquor. Chintibent was a notorious carouser, along with his many other attributes, and he caused Don Antonio to drink tequila and astonishment. And Don Antonio transformed from a carved pillar of righteous strength to a fluid dancing creature of many voices and filthy uproars. For the rest of his life, Angel would long to reduce a house full of people to a choking, bellowing mess like these men did. "Ay, gente," the women would cry. "Ay, Doño." Whether red-faced from laughing or embarrassment, Angel could never tell. "And then," Chintibent shouted, "the elephant stuck the peanut up Pancho's ass." Guffawing, Cuca Bent fell off her chair, and Don Antonio jumped up and goose-stepped around the courtyard, holding his stomach and trying to breathe through laughing. The parrot screamed in his cage as if it understood the joke as well. "Listen, listen," his father said when he caught his breath. Their hilarity died down. The meat still crackled in its red-hot pit. Shrimp heads lay all over the table, staring with their black pencil-tip eyes, and Tiki Bent grinned fairly at Angel with a shiny wet mouth he knew would taste of lime and salt and fish oil. Beer cans and tequila bottles and several glasses covered the table and the ground beneath it. Mama America thinking all the while of sharp knives and testicles. "Listen," Don Antonio repeated, unsteady in the middle of his wobbling shadow, pushed jaggedly across flagstones by lamps hung in the tree. "I have a joke for you. So, little Pepe was playing in the garden."
"Pepe who?"
said Chente Bent.
"Pepe, pues. Any Pepe."
Chente Bent crossed his arms.
"I don't know who you're talking about." "I'm talking about Pepe. Oye, cabrón, it's a joke. There is no Pepe." "If there's no Pepe, why are you talking about him?" "Damn you, pinche Chente. You're imagining things," Chente Bent said, draining his beer and belching softly with a luxuriousness that only a liter of shrimp gas could create.
"Listen, you bastard," cried Don Antonio.
This exchange lived on for Angel as the most deeply amusing moment of the night. It was better than the jokes. He discovered at that moment that he was an absurdist. It came to him as a Zen enlightenment. He fell back in his chair. Tiki Bent ruined the spell by widening her legs for an instant and allowing him a full view of her bloomers.
"Little Pepe," Don Antonio resumed, "was playing in his yard."
"Where did he live?"
"Go to hell, pendejo." "And his grandfather came along and sat on a bench and watched him playing. He called Pepe over and said, 'Look at this earthworm on the ground. He just came out of a hole.'"
Chente Bent raised a finger.
"Excuse me," he said. "What was the grandfather's name?"
"Who cares? It's a goddamn joke. Stop interrupting."
Angel and the women were snickering. Wounded, Chente Bent said,
"It seemed important to you that everybody had a name in this story."
He expressed his sense of futility with his lower lip and the shrug of one shoulder. Don Antonio released a cry of cosmic protest to the heavens and said,
"Carlos! Grandpa is named Carlos. All right? Is everybody happy now?"
"I'm happy, Father," Angel said. Chente Bent yawned.
"Grandpa Carlos showed Pepe there was a damned worm on the ground wiggling around beside its hole. And he said to the boy, 'Pepe, I will pay you a peso if you can put that worm back in its hole.'"
"Cheapskate," Chente Bent noted, using the infuriating Mexican term, codo duro,
he of the hard elbow, which Angel never quite understood. Wisely, Don Antonio ignored Chente Bent, which silenced him.
"So Pepe thought about it," Don Antonio continued, "and ran inside. He came out with his mother's hairspray. He picked up the worm and sprayed it until it was stiff. Then he slipped it down the hole. His grandfather gave him his peso and hurried away. The next day, Pepe was outside playing again. His grandfather came out of the house and gave him a peso.
'But abuelito,' Pepe said, 'you already paid me yesterday.'
Grandfather Carlos said, 'No, Pepe, that peso is from your grandmother.'"
Don Antonio stood there with his arms raised. Suddenly the women burst into cackles, even Mama America.
"Ay, Toño!" Cuca Bent shouted.
After a pause, Chente Bent said, "I don't understand a word you said." This exact moment was when hell came through their gate, and Don Antonio showed Angel that he was a madman and a Pancho Villa. As they all laughed, the gate flew open, and a drunk fisherman staggered into the courtyard with a huge knife, one meant for gutting sharks and tunas, clutched in his fist.
"Chente Bent!" he shouted,
one of the myriad enemies of the odoriferous Bent Corporation. "Come to call.
I slice you open like a pinche fish, cabrón."
The knife swung back and forth, held low like a real knife fighter would hold it.
"You slept with my wife!"
The women cried out. Tiki Bent jumped behind Angel and wailed like a police siren. Don Antonio still stood with his arms stretched wide. He wasn't in uniform, so he didn't have his pistola on his hip. He was sorely disappointed when he reached for it to blow this asshole back out of the gate. For his part, Gente bent down a tequila shot and turned his watery red eyes to his assailant. He didn't seem inclined to rise to his own defense. He didn't know this pendejo, nor could he imagine which of his various paramours might be attached to him. "She wasn't any good anyway," he said, then belched. Mama America rushed to shield Angel with her body, and Tiki Bent moved her aside so she could see the fight. The green parrot in his cage began trying to fly, shaking the cage so badly the seeds rained out on them. Don Antonio turned to the deadly sailor. "You shit," he said.
"What?"
"You vermin. You pig. Watch yourself, you son of a whore. You come into my home and threaten my guests? You dare wave a knife at me? I will kill you and your entire family. I will kill your children, and I will kill your grandchildren. And I will dig up your ancestors and shit in their mouths." "Hey." Don Antonio tore his own shirt open. "Stab me, chingado. If you think you can kill me, stab me now right in my heart. But be sure I'm dead, because I'm about to unleash all of my wrath on you, you fucking dog." The sailor stared at him with true terror on his face. He had no idea who this maniac was, but he was clearly the one man in La Paz the sailor did not want to fight. The sailor didn't even pause to muster his dignity. He spun around, ran into the street, and charged as fast as he could toward the sea, upending trash cans as he fled. For the rest of his life, no matter what he thought of his father, no matter what hardships or sorrows, what humiliations or horrors befell him, Big Angel remembered that moment as the single most heroic thing he would ever witness. He thought he would never be able to be a man like his father. Even Gente Bent clapped his hands, albeit softly. The next day, Angel boarded El Guatabampo and sailed into the hazy blue. He had no chance to bid farewell to his Perla, and her family did not have the technological miracle of a telephone. He tore himself away from the land, choking back tears. Gente Bent hooted the steam whistle incessantly in spite of his own hangover. Life was pain, after all. Leaving Perla, Angel was sure would be the worst of it for him. The last thing his father said to him was, "We need to know, did you sleep with Tiki Bent?" "Qué? Did you sleep with her? Father, no, she's my cousin." "Idiot," his father replied. "You could have done anything you wanted with her." As soon as the boat was out of sight, Don Antonio and his little family walked home. He collected his two bags, gave the two children formal hugs, and, oddly it seemed to everyone, shook Mama America's hand. "If you could have produced more sons," he said, "I would not be forced to leave you." She had a completely still face, thinking, "You vermin." "Take care of my motorcycle until I send for it," was the last thing he said. He trudged away toward the center of town, whistling. America had been planning to murder that damned motorcycle, but she wasn't stupid. She strode over to the machine and ripped the drop cloth off it. "Play," she told the children, who had no idea their world had just ended. And later that day, while her older son vomited operatically into the Sea of Cortez, she sold the motorcycle to a doctor from Cabo San Lucas, for she knew she would have to feed the household. But even that money would eventually run out. She and these two would go hungry. They would even eat the doves in the patio cages and regret that they couldn't bring themselves to kill and cook the parrot. Meanwhile, far across the sea, Angel worked every day and saved his centavos for when he could escape the hell he had unwittingly entered. Chentebent barely paid him. Cucabent did his laundry and cooked for him, and by God, that was generous enough in their opinion. Where Angel had imagined nightly gatherings and uproars he had known during the Bent's invasions of his home, he instead found himself in the outer dark, alone, miserable, hungry, under siege. At first he slept in a little lean-to in the family's small huerta, tucked in among bananas and two mango trees, a date palm full of iguanas, giant spiders that terrified him, and the wash house toilet where he showered in cold water. Mazatlan was almost always warm enough for a cold shower, and so it wasn't the water that bothered him as much as the huge roaches that flew out of the drain. One of his duties was to mop out the evil little toilet room. He had to empty out the tin toilet paper can, since the pipes would not swallow soiled paper. It disgusted him. He held his breath. Chentebent wadded up giant knots of awful paper while allowing Big Angel 5 sheets a day. "Scrub your culo with a sponge," his uncle said. Angel started to sense something was wrong when he learned that the neighbors did not like the Bent clan and tended to shun them. Chentebent's behavior was unacceptable to good Mazatlecos. People on the street were even wary of saying good morning or good afternoon, which was rare in Sinaloa. Rudeness was a real sin to them. He told himself the beatings weren't so bad. Don Antonio could hit harder than Bent could. At least they weren't every day. And Tiki Bent got hit more than he did. He did toilet duty every morning and night, and he raked the huerta, and he swept the house, and he scraped and painted and mopped and hauled nets on the boat. He was hungry all the time. His growling stomach wouldn't let him sleep at night. Cuca Bent and Tiki Bent filled the little toilet bucket with los secretos, things that were best kept secret in his opinion. And then he realized that Tiki Bent left him other things. Underpants draped casually over the edge of the sink, or the door left half open as she showered. He missed his mother and father, and he wept at night, thinking of Perla. He didn't know why it took him so long to write to her. Perhaps it was shyness, or shame. He could not find the words for her, and it was suddenly 6 months later, and he borrowed some paper and an envelope from Tia Cucabent. And he bent to it like some monkey, transcribing scripture, agonizing over each line and crumpling drafts until he was down to his last sheet and had to let the letter go. "Mi dulce perlita," he wrote, then tried a fresh opening, added to this one. "Perla of great price. I miss you like a caged bird misses the sky. I am in a cage, but I will be free. And I will come for you, because I know you miss me as much as I miss you, and we will make a new world." He went on in this vein for a few more lines, and ended with tears and great kisses and exhalations of fervor. He trembled when he took the letter to the mailbox by the docks. In those days, of course, there was only the somnambulistic Mexican Postal Service to deliver messages. And his 10-centavo letter took almost 2 weeks to arrive in La Paz, and his response was tardy in the writing, followed by its glacial delivery, so he didn't hear from her for over a month. A month spent fretting and waiting. It was the epitome of romance in his mind, somehow noble. He felt elevated every day by his suffering for her. A suffering of greater depth and quality than these squalid days as Chentebent's scut boy, but like many lovers before him, awaiting some imagined billet-doux full of grace, he received the letter all dreamers fear most. "Esteemed Angel, Oh, hell no, he thought. He knew already. Say no more. Life had already ended with those two anemic words of greeting. They could have just as easily said, hello, loser. He scanned the bad handwriting for the three lines it took for her to confess. But you never wrote to me, and I have found another. Angel immediately burned Bedla's letter, and he crept to Tiki against his will. He sinned. It was like his little pole dragged him, the most powerful magnet on Earth. Just the sight of Tiki made it start to bounce, like some band conductor's baton, counting out the beats of his broken heart. He thought if Tiki Bent saw this bouncing, she would flee from him. So he wore his shirts untucked. When she saw his shirt tails, Tiki Bent thought he was flying a battle flag to announce his intentions. She took that jumpy twig in hand and strangled it until it relaxed. He was embarrassed to be alive. His hands shook, and he was sure that God would strike him down. His life was shame, betrayed and abandoned by everything and everyone. But before God could be stirred to wrath, Chintabent struck first. He crept out to Angel's hut, reeking of spoiled shrimp and rum. He fell on top of him, breathed in his face. Are you hard? He kept saying. Are you hard? Do you beat it? Do you? He scrabbled for the front of Angel's pants. Let's see that meat. Let's see what you're giving to my girl. Chinta bent, laughing and blowing reek in his face, fat and crushing no matter how Angel kicked. Angel kept thinking, I thought you were a good man. I thought you were funny. Chinta bent collapsed into thunderous snores atop him. He took his first revenge on the pirate the next day. When no one was looking, he scooped large globs of lard out of Kuka Bent's red cans, lard being saved for frying beans, and he smeared it inside the legs of Chinta Bent's favorite canvas pants. When the outraged howling began, Chinta Bent, coming at him with his legs splayed, waddling, red in the face and squishing with every step, Angel stood up to the blows and smiled at Tiki Bent, who watched from her window, ripping at her hair and laughing. He lost a tooth that day. Chinta Bent dragged him roughly to El Guatabampo, his great calloused fingers leaving livid purple imprints on Angel's arms as if he had tattooed dark lilies upon them. Earn your keep, you goddamn freeloader, he said. I'll teach you. Angel had blood on his face, in his mouth. Oh, you'll learn your lesson, you little prick. All Angel had to do was wait. He could outlast anything. He outlasted Chinta Bent's beatings. He outlasted his uncle's grunting visits at night. Only when he was alone did Angel weep, snot all over his face. He slept on a pallet of old blankets in the poxy galley, tucked under the sink, and he scraped and painted and scrubbed and gutted, fished and crabbed and mended nets and served as insomniac watchdog all night, alone. He sometimes had to take gaff in hand and beat back bandits and drunken sailors from foreign ships who crept to the foul boat along the docks. He listened to the drinking and fighting on other boats, the music coming from the shore, the laughter of whores and lovers, and the barking of dogs. When the church bells rang, he felt that the world he knew was in some other land, was too far away to ever be found again. He would show Perla the depth of her mistake. I am worthy. I am worthy, he recited, as if in prayer. He was cut across the chest by a skinny old sailor, who took the gaff to the face and vanished overboard among the oil slicks and dead fish. He bled, watching the old man drag himself up a ladder at the next berth, slimy and wobbly as he stumbled into the night. Fat blood drops splashed at his feet. Angel never said a word, but he remembered the moment, kept it inside him. He wrapped his chest in rags and taped it over, and the fever turned his front red and made him shiver as if snow were falling, but he never told. He stole rum from the galley and dripped it screaming hot into the pus drooling wound. He bit his lips and cried and kicked his feet. He carried on in shock and terror for days out there, waiting for God's wrath or the sailor's comrades, neither of which came. He suspected this entire life was a turn of God's displeasure. He hid his meager pay in a coffee can behind the galley sink, and he found Chente Bent's chest of oily pesos, his operating budget for their fishing expeditions, locked in a cabinet in the wheelhouse. Chente Bent began to charge him for beans and tortillas. He preferred to go hungry. He ate only what was in the boat, even raw bait sardines. He saved every centavo he could. Those nights when he ate, and his guts twisted and groaned inside him, and Perla was so far away, and he feared his mother and brother and sister might be hungry and abandoned across the sea, were the darkest of all. The next time Chente Bent came for him, he had the gaff ready. The pirate had come aboard and already opened his filthy dungarees. An angel swung the gaff with his eyes closed, blind, flailing. He never really thought he'd connect with the side of Chente Bent's head. The hideous crunch of the club hitting the skull, the startled grunt, and the immediate scent of feces. The crippling spike of pain up his own arm when he hit the big man. And the splash. By the time he opened his eyes, for he had kept them clenched for just a moment, in the hopes that what he had just done had not really happened, the big man was sinking into the oily water, his undone pants around his knees. Angel waited for him to surface, but he did not. The rest of that night came in a panic. His memory was never clear, for he was still just a boy, and although he was terrified of what he'd done, he was even more afraid of getting in trouble for it. A thousand lies pulsed through his head. Some part of him believed the fisherman would climb a ladder over at the next mooring and curse at him. He ran back and forth, but there was no magical portal on the Guatabampo that opened to some fresh new world where things were beautiful again. The coffee can of pesos went into his mochila with his two extra pairs of dungarees, his shorts and socks, and his three shirts. He got the box of fishing money out from the main cabin. The boat's extra fuel cans were difficult to lift, but he was strong in his panic. It was all he could imagine now, a fraudulent accident. He saw himself being interviewed by police, perhaps his own father. No, he was drunk. He threw me off the boat and told me to never come back. I took my severance pay and bought a bus ticket. I don't know what happened after I left. I saw nothing. I wanted to join my father. Mama America had finally confided to him in a terse letter that his father had gone north and that she and his siblings would probably follow. He would confront his father for abandoning his family if it was the last thing he did. So he took a bus north, express to Tijuana. It would be 27 hours sitting there, smelling of gasoline. He couldn't sleep. He kept thinking about the throbbing bloom of orange flame visible from the window as the bus had pulled away into the night. It was 1965, and he felt he had already lived 100 years. For decades, he told his mother that he had run away, that he had no idea what happened to El Guatabampo or Tio Chente. He repeated his lie so many times that he almost convinced himself. He had gotten fed up with the work and the bullying and had saved up his money and caught the bus. He assumed that Chente Bent discovered his escape and got drunk and somehow set fire to the boat. He had thought it was over, but the guilt and the lie burned steadily through all of his life. Big Angel stood in the shadows of the living room, buffeted by stories of the past, things he remembered and things he had learned, or maybe things he had dreamed. He could no longer tell the difference. The stories flew in like wind through an open window and whirled around him. He could feel them almost pull him off his feet. They seemed to come by their own volition, leaping over years, ignoring the decades. Big Angel found himself in a time storm. He saw it all as if the past were a movie in the Las Pulgas theater. Little Angel was born in 1967. Big Angel lived with his mother and siblings in Colonia Obrera, in Tijuana, until he snuck across the border to join his father after one of the old man's infrequent visits to their house. It seemed easy to him. People either crept through the shallow brown Tijuana River down near the coast, or joined the crowds running out of Colonia Libertad in Otay to the east. There were regular corridors in those days, and day workers often commuted through the dirt canyons. Big Angel refused to see any other girls. He sent postcards to Perla, which she never answered. Indio was born in 1970. By then, Big Angel was camping out at his father's house and working as a donut cooker on night shift with payments made strictly under the table. One of his first American phrases, under the table. It seemed so elegant. Braulio was born in 1971. Big Angel didn't know any of this, but he wrote Perla a letter that same year begging her to come north. Though the letter was later lost, they both remembered the line, "Come to me while we still have life, and we can wrestle with destiny." It was the noblest thing Perla had ever heard. And she came, throwing everything away to join him. Braulio grew up fast. He had them all fooled. Minnie was just a dumb kid. She worshipped all three of her brothers. But El Indio knew, and Lalo knew what the deal was. And as she got older, Minnie made believe she didn't know. Mama Perla, well, Braulio was her angel. Pops took his standard noble route. Sometimes the boys laughed at him when he wasn't around. So snooty. Nose in the air, making a big show of claiming Indio and Braulio as his sons. The wisest man in the world, by his own estimation, remained blind to these two. Pinche Braulio, his nickname, Snickers, should have said it all. Indio could not stand Big Angel. He was the one who remembered his birth father. Braulio had been too young. Their father had dived for pearls. He shucked oysters with a fat, curved blade and slurped them down with lime juice and red hot sauce. He laughed loud, and when he laughed, his gold tooth shone, and one day he dove into the waters east of La Paz and never surfaced. Indio remembered that. This angel appeared one day as if he'd always been there. Indio was so shocked that his mother had some romantic secret, some filthy little past life. He wrestled with rage, thinking whore some days when he looked at her. Not Braulio. He was a prankster. And when he hooked up with Gloriosa's boy, Guillermo, it was some kind of perfection. They were the same age, the same size. They could have been twins. And the girlies called Guillermo Joker. There was a clear theme. Snickers and Joker. Down por vida, homies. For life. When poor Lalo came along, he never could penetrate their society of two. Things weren't always middle class for the family. They didn't always live in Lomas Doradas, in the happy barrios of Dego Town. And in those years of struggle when Big Angel would not allow anyone to get government help, no welfare, no food stamps, there were lots of boiled beans and fried beans and bean soups. Braulio's favorite breakfast was cold fried beans smeared on a slice of Wonder Bread, eaten while standing in the sad tiny kitchen of their first apartment behind a garage in San Isidro, not 50 yards from the border's barbed wire. Pretty ballsy, since Ma and Pops were both illegal as hell back then. Nights filled with helicopters and sirens and running feet and break-ins. Days watching out for